John Goodbody, the veteran English sports journalist and author of A History of the Olympics for Naxos Audiobooks, recalls some of his favourite memories from the Olympics he has reported on.
No sports event provides such a kaleidoscope of contrasting memories as the Olympic Games. The tiny gymnasts juxtaposed with the super heavyweight weightlifters, the speed of the sprinters with the endurance of the long distance runners, the dexterity of the footballers and basketball players with the unremitting power of the wrestlers and judo fighters. Men and women, large and small, all have their place in the games. For anyone with a wide-ranging interest in sport, attending the games can be a frustrating experience. One is able to see only a fraction of the events, almost all of which feature the world's most outstanding athletes. As it is, by devoting oneself to watching as many of the events as possible, one suffers a type of mental and physical indigestion at the end of the 17 days. It takes me several weeks to recover from this feeling of being sated with observing excellence. I've reported on every Olympics, mainly for British newspapers, since 1968, and I'm often asked which was my favourite. I find this difficult to answer. So much is bound up with the success of one's own work and affected by the conditions of that work and by the performances of the competitors, especially those in the British team. Sydney and Barcelona are always held up by the British media as their favourite games of the last 40 years. But in the case of Sydney, in particular, this was because of the partly unexpected hoard of medals won by the British team. Probably the most adversely criticised games during this period was Atlanta, but this was influenced by the fact that Britain only got one gold medal. It is always more rewarding to write about victories than trying to explain defeats, however narrow the latter may have been. And many journalists, although not me, had vexing experiences with the transport and communications in 1996. Both Moscow and Los Angeles were spoilt by the boycotts. The 1980 Games seemed grey and sombre, while 1984 was too garish, not surprising given its proximity to Hollywood. Neither was really satisfactory. Munich was certainly the most dramatic, largely because of the killing of the Israeli athletes by Palestinian guerrillas, but also because of other highly publicised events and personalities. I have fond memories of all the 10 Summer Olympics that I have covered, although naturally some more than others. My appreciation has always been influenced by my proximity to some of the competitors, whose careers usually climax at the Games. I've selected three special occasions, all of which have been chosen because of the rapport which I, as a journalist, had established to a lesser or greater extent with the individuals concerned. Chronologically, the first occasion was in Moscow in 1980. 12 years earlier, I had beaten, with considerable difficulty, a 15-year-old schoolboy in the London area judo trials. This was Angelo Parisi, already more than 100 kilos, much of it across the chest, shoulders and width of his thighs. Holding him down was like lying on an earthquake. It was the only time I was to beat him. For several years he used to hurl me round the Budokai Club in South Kensington, where we were both members. Although living in London, he held Italian nationality, but he switched to British citizenship, winning 2 European junior and 2 senior titles and an Olympic bronze medal by the age of 19. He then married a French girl and changed nationality again. When I went to work in Paris in 1978, Angelo was an established member of the French squad, and again we saw much of each other. In Moscow, he was picked for the heavyweight category, although he was light for that division. In the final, he met Dimitar Zaprianov of Bulgaria. Angelo was losing with 45 seconds left when he produced one of his textbook throws, uprooting his hapless opponent with a movement in which he got underneath Zaprianov and threw him on his back, falling on top of him with the effort. As the two men landed, the mat visibly bounced, and the crowd rose to its feet in appreciation of a spectacular winning throw. As Angelo said to me afterwards, je l'ai baisé, which roughly translated is, I screwed him. Indeed he did. 4 years later in Los Angeles, Seb Coe achieved successive Olympic victories in the 1500 metres, something that no one had ever achieved before. Recovering from illness, he had missed the key international races of the 1983 season, and there were doubts about whether he would ever recover his former eminence. I saw Seb win the Middlesex 800 metres title in Enfield in May 1984, and he was obviously making remarkable progress. But to retain his Olympic 1500 metres would demand much from him, especially as his opponents, included his compatriots Steve Ovett and Steve Cram, the world European and Commonwealth champion. After finishing second in the 800 metres in Los Angeles, he was nicely placed in the back straight of the final of the 1500 metres, following the pace of the Spaniard José Manuel Abascal. When Cram moved up to Seb's shoulder, the defending champion took off. Although Cram followed him, Coe had a lead of more than a metre as they entered the home straight. One waited for Cram's acceleration. It never came. Instead, it was Seb who broke away, crossing the line as clear winner. He then wheeled around towards the press box, his index finger outstretched, shouting, "Who says I'm finished?" Underneath his amiable demeanour was the will of the champion that he was. Fast forward now to 2000 and a Saturday morning at the rowing course in Sydney. Steve Redgrave was attempting to be the first person in an endurance event ever to win gold medals in 5 successive games. After their victories in Olympics and World Championships in the Coxless pairs, Redgrave and his partner Matthew Pinsent moved into a Coxless 4 in 1997 and promptly won 3 more world titles, despite Steve himself being forced to take insulin for diabetes. However, in June 2000, the four only finished 4th at the Lucerne Regatta. Under the guidance of their coach, Jürgen Grobler, they regrouped and came back fighting. At the final in Sydney, with Pinsent at stroke, they led from the start. It was only in the last 200 metres that the Britons were really worried, when the Italian crew began a charge for the line. The Italians got closer and closer, but the British four held on and crossed the finish 0.48 seconds ahead. Then, in a typical gesture of comradeship, Matthew clambered over their crewmate, Tim Foster, and embraced Redgrave before tumbling into the Penrith Lake. All the while, I was desperately writing a few new paragraphs to my story to catch the last edition of the Times in London. I had hardly had time to savour the victory, but I have had time subsequently. Barely a month goes by when I don't recall at least one of these 3 memories, and for much of the rest of the time I'm thinking of other occasions I have witnessed at the world's greatest sports event. And then there was Athens, the historical home of the Olympics. Never has there been such a feeling of history, with the events taking place amid heated competition, records broken. At the end of each day, after filing the final report, he was back to Athens, where, standing high above the Plaka with its busy restaurants and lively activity, was the Acropolis, dominating the town as it has done for thousands of years. Beijing, capital of the most populous country in the world, was finally granted the Olympics in 2008. These games were splendidly organised, if a little soulless, but they celebrated the exploits of 2 Olympians, Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt and also American swimmer Michael Phelps, who achieved what no one has ever done before, win 8 gold medals at the same games.